Hi, this is Julia Wallmüller from Deutsche Kinemathek in Berlin, and you're listening to the Film Swap podcast.
Here's part two of our conversation with Julia Wallmüller from the Deutsche Kinemathek in Berlin. In this episode, we talk about the restoration of the films of G.W. Pabst, the experimental work of Doré O, and Early Sound. We really enjoyed chatting to Julia, and we hope you enjoy it too.
Here is a motion picture film. Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel.
Welcome back, listeners, and welcome back, Julia and Jonathan.
Hi.
So, Julia, some of the other types of projects you work on, you don't just work on silent films, but you work on films from all different eras of film. And one project that you brought to our attention that we thought would be quite interesting to touch on was the experimental films of a lady called Doré O. She was an artist who worked from sort of late 60s, early 70s, is that correct?
Yes, and that's correct.
Would you be all right for people who might not be familiar with Doré O about maybe tell the listeners just a little bit about her, just to give a little bit of background about her work and the types of things that you were working on?
Yeah, Doré O was one of the most important German experimental filmmakers, a female experimental filmmakers, which at the time she started was quite rare. There were not many women working in this field. So she was originally painting and came to filming also, to making experimental films. She was living and working together with Werner Nekes, who was at this point also one of the most important experimental filmmakers. They lived first in Hamburg, where they co-founded together with other people the Film Cooperative in Hamburg. And so they were kind of very important figures, both of them, in this scene of experimental cinema and initiating, you know, film screenings, and which turned into also important festivals later on for this scene, and marking really a very impressive scene in experimental filmmaking. She has been filming, I think, since the mid 60s, and later films, among the films that we digitized and restored are films from 68 until the 80s. I'd say that's what we basically worked on. I have to give the credit for the restoration of the films of Doré O, mainly to my dear colleague Masha Matzke, who was working on most of the films. We worked together on the film Alaska, for example. That was the first project that we did for her, for Doré, when she was still alive. And it's a very special work to work on a film like this. You have to get to know the way the films were made, the way the films were produced also, which is a special situation often in this field, because these films were made also in not standard workflow, let's say. The people were experimenting with the material out of passion, and you know, there was not really a budget for projects like this. So the films are puzzled also together out of different materials, trying out different experiments with the film material.
Were these films, like, because they were shot, a lot of them on sort of 16 millimeter kind of reversal stock and things like
yes.
that. And were there a lot of prints made of these films, or were they the kind of things that were shown at very specific screening events? They wouldn't have had like a wide distribution like they would like a commercial fiction film.
Exactly. At least they didn't expect it that way, I'd say, because what you can see with these films, we had this situation with most of the Doro films and also from the same time Werner Nikes films, I find the same situation now, that they had, it's true, they had many films produced on color reversal film stock. So this film stock where you have, you develop it into a positive without having a negative. And these films have a very special look. They have a different way of reproducing colors and a different density than the films produced in negative-positive process. So it's also a special choice to work with this material, but it's also, of course, cheaper because you don't have to do a negative and then print positive prints from the negative. So what we have in these productions is often that you had positive prints directly printed from the original color reversal film stock. So again, using reversal film stock to produce prints. There were several prints. And then some years later, they produced, because they maybe then realized, oh, we need more prints because we are quite successful with what we're doing. And they have been shown quite a lot always because they really had a good perception. So they made a negative from their original color reversal original, and from this negative then they produced positive prints, so they changed the strategy. So this is what happened with lots of Doris films, and for example with the film Alaska, which is a film from 1968, we have the original materials and prints from the early phase, which are reversal prints. So they look quite, from the color and everything, the density, they are quite close to the camera original, actually. Whereas the prints that have been produced later from an internegative, they look quite differently. So there's a... that was the tricky situation in the case of Alaska, when we laid hands on it.
Go ahead, Jeremy.
What my question, the films are not very sort of linear. There's not much in the way of narrative, the ones I saw at least. But I mean, they're very experimental films. So are there any missing pieces? And I mean, how on earth do you figure out what goes where when putting those back together?
Well, luckily those films... often don't need to be put back together. Also, for these projects, you would start with comparing the film materials, and if everything goes well, then you know you compare the different prints that you can find, and you compare them with the original camera material. And if the edit is the same, then you don't have a problem in this sense. You don't have to re-edit anything. So it could happen that you have different versions of a film, for example, an earlier version that has been maybe shortened a bit, or maybe there could be a change in the edit. This happens. We also had this with some Doro films, but you can basically find out about those changes when you compare the prints with each other. Mm-hmm. And then you would have to choose, okay, what's my strategy? What do I consider a valid, more original print? And which print is my main reference for the further work?
And how about the sort of sound and music and that side of it? Similar?
That's basically the same, yeah. You also do comparison of the sound elements that you have of the prints, of course, but then also, you know, you have the magnetic tape where you have the original sound, and you compare it with the prints and you try to figure out, are there any differences? Of course, yeah, the sound is quite different to compare. You have this, I think in Alaska, you have this constant... kind of noise, which is a combination of different sounds put together, getting very loud at a certain point. So it's not not like comparing a normal film sound, but that's what you actually always work like this. You compare elements with each other, and then you try to figure out what was the original form of the film at the time the film was released. And for example, if you look at the prints, if you look at those different kinds of prints that I described, what is very important is also it's not just about edit or the content of the film, but also about the appearance. So what was the original appearance of the film? What did the colors look like? What were how dark was it? How light was it? How hard were the contrasts? How intense were the colors?
How do you make those kind of decisions? Because with films like this, where quite often the images, there's a lot of sort of double exposures and odd lighting techniques and sort of, more sort of distorted imagery and things. How do you know whether that's was intentional or not when you are looking at those things and you're trying to convert them to create a digital version that looks like the original? How do you make those decisions about what, like, was that supposed to be like that, or is that some wear on the film print, or how can you make those estimations?
Usually the process in the digital restoration workflow where you have to decide concerning colors, lights, and so on, contrasts, is the digital color grading. So in the color grading, we work together with professionals who do this as a job in post-production, for example. And if we are happy, we can work with somebody who has experience with analog film and restoration projects. Usually for this part of the work, we use prints. We try to find a good print from the original production period. And we watch the prints in projection in a cinema. And we watch them together with the digital colorist, with the person who is doing the actual technical work. And if we can, we watch it with the filmmakers, if they are still alive and if they are interested in participating in the project. So that's when we work on films from the second half of the last century, we often find ourselves in the lucky situation to be able to work with the directors or the DOPs in some cases. And we invite them to join the process, to be there and try together to figure out what the film looked like. And in the best case that we can have is really that we have a good print, a reliable print, where we can see exactly those, that gives us these guidelines about the appearance of the color and everything. So, and then the next step would be... 16
millimeter reversal film stock from, say, 50 years ago, how does that hold up in comparison to some of the nitrate stocks and things that you were talking about from earlier silent films? Do they hold up better?
Well, yes and no. I mean, they don't burn, but anyway, they fade to red, especially color film stock. often is faded. So that's a big problem, a big issue. It doesn't have to be like this. It also depends on how the film has been stored. It depends on the manufacturing phase. You know, there were more stable years, like you have better and worse years for wine. You have better and worse years for color film stock, because they were constantly trying to improve, to work on certain aspects. And then some years you really have this very, very instable colors that fade away almost instantly. And then again, we have films from the 70s, from the 60s, who are at least the originals in perfect condition, and the colors are beautiful still. Mm-hmm. So, for example, for Alaska, which was really a funny thing or an interesting example, we had I think, 5 different prints. And all the prints look different.
Hmm.
Not just that, in the way that one print looked a bit more reddish and the other one more greenish, but the single scenes, the single motifs, I would say, because it's hard to talk about scenes with this kind of images that you have in experimental film. It's more like motifs let's stick to motifs. They all looked different within each other. So one image that would look greenish in one print would look totally different in another one, or one that was printed in black and white in one print would be printed in orange in another one. So it was not, you know, you really could not tell which was a good print, because every print had its own way of changing colors constantly and changing the look constantly. So that was really a special case, because usually you can say, okay, this print is a bit reddish. I know why, because the color fades and red is the most stable color of the colors in the film. So that's why they turn reddish. They have this red appearance. And in this case, it was really impossible to figure out which print would be a good reference. On top of that, as you said, you have these very, you know, not realistic looking images, double exposures or multiple exposures, and of course they were playing with, you know, superimpositions and dark scenes and very light scenes, and nothing looks natural. So you don't have any guideline at all if you don't have a good print, not any really. So it's really crucial to find a print. And in the case of Alaska, it was impossible to decide which print would be a good reference for us. So we talked to Dora and we said, can't you come to Berlin? She was living in Mülheim an der Ruhr, which is kind of the center of Germany, in the famous Ruhrpott. I'm sure you know what I mean. she said, no, she just can't, because she was not in the physical condition to travel to Berlin. And so what we normally do is invite the filmmakers here and do the work together. But since it wasn't possible for Dora at this time, we decided to pack the prints in a suitcase and go to where she was. So Masha and I, we packed the prints in a suitcase and went to Mülheim an der Ruhr. And Dora organized a screening at a place called Makroskop, which was kind of a center for experimental images, I think, if I recall it correctly. Very, very nice people that arranged a screening environment for us with a projector, a 60mm projector, and we watched those 5 prints a whole afternoon. The film is about 40 minutes long, I think. So we watched 5 prints. And we prepared some kind of scene or motif protocol where we took notes. And she could not tell us before, well, this motif should look like this or like that. But when she saw the prints, she could say, well, this looks right. No, but this doesn't look right. And so she was quite sure in the moment that she saw it, which should be the right way. And we took the notes, and then we tried to reconstruct the color appearance based on those notes that we had.
Wow.
So it was really tricky. And then she saw the result and she was very happy with it.
So that was something you really needed therefore. Otherwise you'd have just been sort of guessing, essentially.
We would have been kind of lost.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Kind of lost, because really, if you can't even say a print changed in a certain way, like everything turns a bit red, you know, you can abstract this reddish tone. You can just take it away and try to guess what the image looked like. But in this case, apparently, every time they printed, I mean, you did this in analog film production, you do determine in the color timing process, which is the analog color grading, you would set lights and colors for each and every shot. And apparently they did it in different ways for the different prints. And we found marks on the original also indicating that they had been doing this in a different way. Always, at least they made different marks for every time they printed, or I'm not sure. We also tried to phone every person I could guess, phoning, trying to find out where these prints were made and in which way, and but you know, nobody could help. Right. Sometimes it's like that. But yeah, especially for these films, it's really crucial to have good prints. So I'm right now working on Vernonikis films, and I also have lots of prints, but I can say quite with I can be quite sure about which prints are good and which are not. Mm. And usually the older ones that are on color reversal film are better in most cases.
Well, they are certainly really interesting films. I quite enjoyed watching them. Alaska is amazing, but all of them are really cool. I was going to ask you a question about some of the music in some of the later films, because mm-hmm. were these pieces of music that were recorded specifically for the projects, or were they pre-recorded music that she chose to accompany the images? Some of them reminded me of kind of like those Alfred Deller recordings, you know, the kind of ancient vocal folk songs and things, those mm-hmm. kind of recordings. So they kind of reminded me of that. So I was just curious about whether she chose pre-existing music or whether they were made specifically for the film.
Really depends. Sometimes it's not even music, but just sounds, like different sounds put together. Like in Alaska, I think it's you can hear some violin sounds, but also yeah. some strange, maybe a hairdryer, or it's just so many sounds put together that it's hard to find out. For some of her films, the music was made by Anthony Moore, who is also quite known apparently in the circle of experimental film, but also experimental music people, and he composed or created music to some of her films also. But what is quite obvious often when you see those films, but it really depends on the film, that the music is, or the sound is not, you know, like composed in a way that you would compose for a normal film. So it's more like a piece of music or a piece of sound for a piece of film, not to be synchronized too much.
We also could create that atmosphere and things that sort of adds to the mystery or allure of the images that you're seeing.
Yes. But it really depends. So in the case of Alaska, for example, one thing about the prints was that the music, which is faded in at the beginning of the film over a very long fade-in, was, and this was done differently in every print, so obviously manually in every print, sometimes the fade-in would last like 20 seconds and sometimes it would last 2 minutes or something like this. And so that's also something that we at a certain point had to decide, okay, we will use this and this print as a reference for the way the sound has been faded in.
Mm. Well, yeah. It was really interesting. I think I might take an opportunity just to quickly plug the DVD for this, because you very kindly sent me the link so I could get one, but it's called Figures of Absence, The Films of Doro, and it's a DVD, and it's available from a company called Revoir. And I can include the link to that in the show notes, so that if people are interested in checking this out, which I think they should be, they can pick this up, because it's a really, really fascinating collection of short films And I really enjoyed it a lot, and I can see myself going back to that.
And if you're interested in her work, you should certainly watch out for the book published by Masha Matzke, my colleague, with the same name, Figures of Absence. So there is also a book about Dora Oar, a beautiful book, where you can see...
Is that out now? Is it available now, or is that...
Yes, it is available. It has been published more or less at the same time, like the DVD.
Oh, okay.
So they go together.
Well, definitely. I mean, it sounds
very
like...
nice image material and very good texts in the book as well.
Okay, and the lady who wrote the book was your colleague who worked on the restoration.
Yeah, she actually, yes.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Okay, well, yeah, definitely, folks. I'll include a link in the show notes so that you can go and investigate that further, because they are definitely really interesting, and it's worth checking out. If it's okay, just before we wrap up, I wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of films that you worked on. From what I understand from our initial conversations, you weren't initially involved in the project, but you sort of became involved after it had started. But there's a couple of films by G.W. Papps that were recently released on home media called West Front 1918. And I want to make sure I say this right, Kameradschaft.
Yeah, that's quite good.
It would be in English, that would translate to sort of comradeship.
Comradeship, exactly. Yeah. I think that's the international title.
But these are two really, really, really brilliant films, like just, you know, masterpieces, really. And they both go together really well, because West Front 1918 is sort of it gives you a firsthand account of life in the trenches during the First World War. And then the second film tells the story of a mining disaster that happens on the French and German borders after the war. And they kind of go together because they sort of show, they share some of the same cast and things as well, but they kind of show the experience of the soldiers during the war and just everyone during the war, really. And then kind of shows how the workers and everyone came home and the kind of economic conditions and the sort of working conditions and stuff that they experienced after. And they're both really brilliant kind of anti-war films, because they show very much the idea of people helping out one another when there's adversity, and overcoming these sort of nationalistic sort of barriers when there's crisis and things. And I think they're really, really, really amazing films. The Kameradschaft, especially some of the quite harrowing conditions in the mines. And apparently this was all shot in a studio, which I was quite surprised to read about. But some of these scenes are incredibly harrowing and very realistic. In these conditions, working in these mines, and then when the catastrophe happens and the shaft starts to collapse and things like that, it's very realistic, very harrowing and exciting. And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because you were involved in these restorations and they're such great films, some of the challenges about restoring them. Certainly in the case of the second film, there's even bits missing, isn't there? There's one point where a title card comes up to say, well, this scene's missing, and it sort of describes it. And there's all throughout the film, there's little bits where there's frames missing and things. So could you tell us a little bit about the process of reconstituting these films?
Yes. There were different challenges. I mean, for West Front, we had the challenge also that we had lots of missing parts. Both films are based, again, on material that has been preserved in the British Film Institute National Archive. So what would we do without you? And these were duplicate positives with sound that have been preserved there, that have been obviously produced for the international market. West Front 1918 had been shortened quite a bit. Apparently, many scenes missing and also bits and pieces missing. And so the aim for this restoration was also to try to fill the gaps, which of course for a sound film is even more crucial than for a silent film, because you would also have a gap in the sound. And that's what makes it more complicated as well. To fill the gaps, there was a material conserved in Bundesarchiv from the Präsenzfilm collection there. And well, Pabst is as you might heard, very famous for his kind of cutting. And it's said that for his editing, and it's said that, you know, it was not by coincidence where he did choose to do a cut. And how and that it was always on total purpose, the choice on until which frame exactly a scene should last. So it's this thing about the Pabst films that you say you have to really try to reconstruct everything in full length, which is more like, again, a silent film topic. But in this case, we have sound. It was the first sound film, West Front 1918, by Pabst, and the soundtrack is also quite heavy. I mean, you described the really natural images, but also the sound is really heavy. And I just read a review, or not the review itself, but somebody telling from the premiere of the film that many people left the cinema shouting out that this was just unbearable. And how can you dare to show something like this to us?
Wow.
1930, right? So people were still very traumatized, and obviously he Pabst as well. And that's what he tried to do also with this terrible ending and this very strong message also at the end of the film.
Yeah.
And so... this material in this British material that we had has a soundtrack. The sound was typical for this period, a bit difficult. It is a special sound track that is called variable density soundtrack. It doesn't look like modern film sound. Maybe you have seen the way the soundtrack looks like today, more like this curve from the hospital monitors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Back then, it was it looked more like a leather, so it is different kinds of densities. A track with different densities, and each density represents a certain way of sound. So it's a different system, which has generally more problems. You have more noises getting into the film sound that could disturb you. And it's a very, very, it depends very much on the quality of the printing that has been done, and also the quality of the digitization that you do. So you have to digitize those sounds with a special technique, usually, and be sure not to bring in more problems digitizing the sound than it actually has. So we had lots of sound restoration done on this film. And of course, it was also a big challenge to match the different sounds from this British material and the German material that was used to fill the gaps that we had in the British material. And there was lots of work necessary. And sometimes maybe you notice that it's a bit hard to understand. The sound quality is not very good, but they tried their best to really get out as much as possible from the sound that was there. But the understandability of the sound of the dialogues is a big issue in this early 30s, the early, very early sound films.
So all the sound was original sound you managed to find. You didn't have to, I mean, there's lots of explosions.
Reconstructible.
You didn't have to get sort of explosion sounds or anything like that to sort of fill it in.
No.
Okay.
I mean, from old materials, yes.
It was all, yeah.
Yes, there was no original sound negative that surely existed somewhere, but right. didn't exist anymore. The original negative of this film also is lost. And image-wise, it was the same like I described before with Waxworks, trying to match certain looks that don't look alike, trying to match them. And in the case of Westfront, there was even a special technique used, which was if you change from one source to the other and you had the change in image quality, fadings, small fadings were done. So we had small fadings over, I guess, like 2 to 6 frames where one source would, one image would fade into the other one to make the change smoother. That's something you could really, you really have to question, in my opinion. The decision was made. I wouldn't have made it myself that way, I would say, because it's creating new images, actually. Those faded, digitally faded images have not been there before, so you don't have to just one change. You don't have just one change from one material to the other, but also newly created images in these fadings. The effect can be positive because it's smoother. You don't have these interruptions, so it's maybe better for the audience to watch. But it's something that you can, you know, regard with a critical view, certainly. As you see, decisions, options and decisions. It's the important thing is that for me, if you take such a decision, that you communicate this also and you make it, you know, transparent, you document it so it can be understood what you did. In the end, what has been done within these digital restorations is, and also the analog restorations before, is creating new versions. Also, a print from a very old nitrate print is a new print, is a new version. Of course, now we go digital, which is a fundamental change of image, but still, it's a new version. Anyway, this version can be, should be, as close to the original as possible. But, of course, you know, depending on the person working on the project, taking the decisions, this will be... there are many, many ways of producing this new version.
So do you still preserve the original, like before you, like if, when you make these changes, do you still save the other?
The film material, yeah. Of course, that would be the most important thing.
Well, it's always yes. possible that future generations, like in another sort of 30, 40, 50 years, someone else might sit down and try and do another restoration.
Yes.
Like if they find some additional materials or something, they might sit down and try again to do it. So it's important yes. to document those decisions so that they can potentially undo them if they wanted to or...
Totally. And usually you also archive the raw scan of the film, meaning when you scan the film before you do any intervention to the image, you would archive this one, which is especially important for material which has deterioration going on because, you know, the film will not be in the same condition in 30, 40 years when somebody might take the decision to do something differently than you have done it. So, but if you preserve the raw scan and it's a good quality, a high quality scan, then the next generation really has the possibility to work with the raw scan in case the original film material has is just in a much worse condition and maybe cannot be used in the same way anymore. So that's what usually is done.
But doesn't that bring up its own kind of challenges, though, in terms of the technology? Because you could do a scan now and it's preserved on a hard drive or something, but then there's a reliance on that technology still being useful 30, 40, 50 years from yes. now, and that those pieces of equipment will still work. Or, you know, so there's always this constant process of having to try and back everything up and save everything as
yes,
much
migration.
As
possible. Migration. Yeah. And of course, as an archive, that's what we deal with constantly. We produce data, lots of data. And because if you do a 4K scan of a film, you have tons of data. And so you have to migrate them all the time to keep them accessible. And usually you have systems and you have to, you know, double store them because you cannot risk that one system is breaking down. So you have a double or triple storage and mm-hmm. you have to migrate your systems and never just leave it in the shelf on a hard drive because the hard drive maybe next year will not work anymore if you don't use it. So that's a whole machinery running behind those shelves, not literally, but that's what colleagues of me are dealing with, how to keep all this data accessible. Yeah.
Do you see in the future, can you see other technologies on the horizons or any sort of developments in sort of restoration technology and things that could potentially improve or make your work easier in the future or better? Or do you know of things on the horizon?
Easier and better, I'm not sure for the moment. I mean, there are, of course, technologies that are being offered, like HDR technology, which to my understanding is maybe interesting for companies who want to just, you know, release Blu-rays of old films and do cover this kind of market. As far as I understood, for what we aim at is which is cinema, seeing films in cinema. That's our main objective. Blu-rays are nice to have, but we restore for the cinema. And HDR, as far as I understand, is not the relevant technology at the moment for cinema projection.
Mm. It's fundamentally sort of recolor grading things again as well, isn't it? It's changing, isn't it? When they go in and do these new HDR masters, they're kind of grading the colors and things, aren't they? So.
Yes, the appearance. I mean, in theory, you can show more detail and, you know, but then you have to wonder, okay, who will be equipped at home properly to see all those details? And sometimes when you, I mean, for me, it's always hard to see the outcome of a restoration on any kind of screen, which is not a cinema screen, because the way the colors are being displayed on the monitor is always wrong. It's always hard to look at this material on something that is not cinema screen.
It is, especially because a lot of these modern televisions, they add in so much extra processing
and
things like that.
The colors are more intense.
Yeah, and the average person, when they get a new TV, they just kind of whack it in and just leave it on the default settings, and they don't necessarily calibrate them and things as well. So I often see in people's, when I go over to visit other people in their houses, the televisions have really sort of day glow colors, and the motion smoothing makes everything really jittery. Yeah. And they don't even seem to notice. And I'll be sitting there.
You get used to it, or you even made the choice. No, you maybe even took the settings, made the settings in that way. So that's difficult. And of course, AI is also something that is constantly being offered to archives to make the work easier. I don't know, because what I see, I mean, of course, within the digital workflow, we work with quite advanced technology. We work with tools that are especially designed for film restorations in terms of retouching images, so removing scratches or removing dust or damage from the digitized images. And these are very specialized tools. and it's just algorithms in the end. But seeing the different kinds of results that you can have depending on the person, choosing the parameters for those tools, and that they are quite complex. It's not just, you know, press the button and go. So for each tool, you have lots of parameters which influence the way the tool works and the way the tool works without creating digital artifacts or with creating digital artifacts. That's something, it's a very important topic when you talk about retouching of images, digital retouching. Then you can ruin the material completely by creating new artifacts. So you see the different outcome depending on the person, you know, on the people working with those tools. So if I imagine, an AI setting those parameters, evaluating if errors have been made or if the outcome is good or... I think still a bit difficult for me to imagine, but I'm a restorer, so I'm not the most modern person, maybe.
One of the interesting stories at the moment in the news is this, you know, Vesuvius project, how they're sort of analyzing, using AI, these scrolls that were sort of incinerated at in the explosion at Vesuvius, as a Pompeii and Herculum, whatever it's called. And so basically they've got these sort of charred lumps, essentially, and they're sort of using AI to figure out the script on them. And so two or three weeks ago, they got their sort of first results, I think. Perhaps it was just before Christmas. And I slightly wonder, well, perhaps they could use a sort of similar thing for sort of... with the cakes, the celluloid cakes, to find out what the film looked like. I don't know. Maybe it's easier with charred papyrus than it is with celluloid.
Guess not. It's not just baked together this cake. It's also that I don't know if you once saw. I mean, they're beautiful images of decomposed nitrate film material. What happens is also that, you know, the image, the silver image, is embedded in a gelatin emulsion. And what happens if all this is decomposing, that the image just melts away within the emulsion. So you have this really, they are very nice artistic projects using this kind of material and making experimental films out of it. It's really beautiful how the image disappears into the emulsion. So it just vanishes. But of course, I mean, what you say, analyzing the image, that's something that we already apply, but not within artificial intelligence tools, but within those tools the digital retouching is working with. So it's analyzation of image content, comparing several images with each other and trying to find out, if I have a white spot here, what is happening on the same spot in the adjacent frames? And is this something that belongs to the image, or might it be a dust or something? You know, that's how it works. Analyzation and then... maybe replacement.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe you also heard the famous story about the Snow White, you know, the Disney film where the sparkling of the diamond cave has been retouched away.
No, I haven't heard that. So we use the algorithm on it today.
Sparkling appears on one frame only, like dust. Also, if you have a water surface where you have reflections of light, they appear on just one frame. And that's how dust is defined for those algorithms. Mm-hmm. White things that appear on one frame only. But fortunately, we have, as I say, parameters that let us control those tools. And we have people sitting there controlling those parameters. So
funny.
Yeah, but I'm sure AI tools are used already, of course, in certain, it's important to differentiate between film restoration and things like remastered versions, or, you know, as I said, remastering for Blu-ray editions only. The thing is that everything can claim to be a restoration. That's a bit of a problem because this is not a protected term, right. Restoration, or a restorer is not a protected profession.
Yeah.
So you could call everything a restoration. So just watch everything with an open eye.
You know, I have a real pet peeve as a collector of films on Blu-ray and things when, you know, because a lot of these film libraries have changed hands over the years for different corporate entities. And every time someone else takes over a library, they reissue a film, they have this thing about they have to take the original distributor's sort of logo off the beginning of the film and then put their own corporate branding on the films. And that just drives me crazy. Studio Canal is one that they do it all the time. They sort of strip off the original sort of headers at the beginning of the films and add their own sort of branding. And that kind of thing really annoys me because I think when I purchase a film, I want as close to the original as it was originally seen in the cinemas when it was released. So for me, any kind of alterations of any kind are, I find it offensive. Sorry, George Lucas, but you know, so that's why I think you're doing God's work, aren't you? Because you're out there and you and your colleagues are working hard to preserve, you know, these historical artifacts and these bits of our culture and things, and keeping them alive for future generations. And I think that's it's very important and very, very great. Just in the interest of time, because it is getting on a bit, and I could quite happily listen to you talk about film restoration for hours, but you probably want to go home and go to bed at some point.
It's been a long day.
If I may, could I just ask you, is there any kind of current projects that you're working on or things that you could let the audience know about that are coming up that you'd like to draw attention to or tell people to watch out for?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm diving very deep into Vananika's films now, and I'll be doing that mostly for the rest of the year. We've already made the plans, and I I guess it's going to be me working on those films, and certainly since he's a very important figure in this field, I suppose that there will be chances to see the restorations, I hope, also internationally. And I can only recommend also for the Doro films, if you have the chance to see them in cinema, go to the cinema. That would be my recommendation anyway for all films. Watch out for the programs of the, you know, the BFI, I'm sure, also has a very nice program. For example, but these films really have to be seen in cinema. So experimental films, the experience that you make with image and sound on the big cinema screen is just totally different from small screens, and sometimes just bearable there, I'd say. So the film I just finished, Divan by Vananikas, is something like this. And then I'm also working on a Lubitsch film from 1918, The Eyes of the Mummy Ma.
Oh, yes.
Roughly translated.
I have a copy of that somewhere, but it's very, very
which cool. Has a severe blackfacing issue, but 1918. Well, back to the question from before. Yeah, but it's also a very interesting, challenging reconstruction project. Still deep into the reconstruction phase. So there's some work to go, and I hope, since it's Lubitsch, Pola Negri, and Emil Jannings, I hope we're going to be able to show it also on an international level.
Yeah, oh, definitely. We'll keep an eye out for that, because that sounds amazing. I will, because I always do, but I totally wholeheartedly agree with you that seeing these things up in a cinema on the big screen is always ideal. But obviously, it's not always practical for people as well. So I will just draw attention again to some of the things that we talked about tonight. The PABS films are available from Masters of Cinema, and there's also Criterion editions in the United States. And I think you showed me earlier a really lovely edition from Germany of the...
Yes, it's the Atlas film edition of those two PABS films. Really beautiful with very nice booklets inside, where you can read some reviews from the time of production and interesting texts also about the restoration of the films. Very nice edition.
So collectors, look out for those. And also we talked about Waxworks, which is also available from Masters of Cinema in the UK. And I believe Flickr Alley does Blu-ray in the United States. So again, they're really interesting films, really worth checking out, whether you can see them in a cinema or get the Blu-rays or see them on streaming or however you get your films, check them out. And I'll put note in the show notes about the Figures of Absence, the Doro films, so that people, if they are interested, they can look out. There's a DVD and also the book as well, all about her work. And it's very interesting stuff. So by all means, check it out. And I'll mention, too, that on the Waxworks Blu-ray, there is an interview with yourself, isn't there, Julia? Talking about the restoration of the film and some of the detective work that went into restoring it. So if you want to hear more, by all means, go and check that out as well, because it's excellent.
Thank you.
So great. Oh, I have one more question. Just looking at your shelves behind you, any chance at all possibly that you've got the Magnificent Ambersons kicking around back there somewhere?
Well, we have some quite famous Berlin film here, maybe by the Berlin-based filmmaker Rosa von Praunheim, quite known here for his filmmaking. Which is called Berliner Bettwurst, but it wouldn't say anything to you now, I fear. I mean, everything is German here.
Do you have a dark little corner of stuff that you haven't cataloged yet and you don't know what it is, and there might be some amazing treasures lurking somewhere in the corner?
I guess we have more or less cataloged everything, which doesn't mean that we have looked into every can. So sometimes really it still happens that, something is written on the can and something else is inside. So this happens also with newer films. To me, it happened, for example, with the film by Rosa von Praunheim that I just mentioned, a film about Anita Berber, a famous German nude dancer from the 20s, and he made a film about her. And there was, for example, a can where there was supposed to be the trailer inside, and there was a trailer, but there was also the original material from the film itself. So that was a nice surprise, even within a film from the 80s. Right. So that happens.
Oh, well, that must be one of the most fun parts of the job, when you finding the little treasures.
Yes.
And it's going, hey, what have we got here? Amazing.
Every time you open a film can, something awaits you. Sometimes it's an ugly surprise, and sometimes it's a beautiful, nice surprise.
Fantastic. Well, it's great. I mean, like I said, if I you let me in there, you'd probably never get me out. I'd be like, oh, what's this? Well, Julia, thank you so much for taking time out to speak to us. It's been amazing, really interesting, and we really appreciate you taking time out to come and speak to us. Hopefully you'll come back again and tell us more of that when you have some more interesting projects that come out, and you can come back and tell us a bit more about that. That'd be lovely.
Yeah, with pleasure. Thank you very much for your interest and your questions.
Terrific. Thank you very much. It's been fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
I'm glad.
Well, all right. Well, listeners, thanks so much for joining us. And we hope you enjoyed the show. And Jonathan and I will be back in a couple of weeks to talk about some more great films. And we hope to see you then. Until then, take care. And we'll see you soon.
Yep. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Film Swap podcast. If you like this podcast, please consider giving the show a rating or leaving a review. This helps other listeners find the show. You can follow the Film Swap on social media. We're on Twitter and TikTok at Film Swap UK, on Instagram at Film Swap Media, and on YouTube at Film Swap _podcast, and at Facebook at Film Swap The Podcast.
All the things these nerdy middle-aged men get up to.